For much of a year, Sebastian Younger and three friends walked the railroad lines of the East Coast as an experiment in personal autonomy, but also interdependence. Dodging railroad cops, sleeping under bridges, cooking over fires, and drinking from creeks and rivers, the four men forged a unique reliance on each other. Sebastian's latest book, Freedom, weaves his account of this journey together with primatology, boxing strategy, the history of labor strikes and Apache raiders, the role of women in resistance movements, and the brutal reality of life on the Pennsylvania frontier. I'm Greg Riday, listening to the Portland Podcast. We're an ad-free show, bare bones and straight to the point, much like our guest today. Please rate us on iTunes, let us know how we're doing. We'd love to hear from you, and you can love our chat with the man of the hour, Sebastian Younger, right now, fresh from his appearance on the Joe Rogan Podcast. It's great. You're doing so much press for this book, and I'm really glad because I really enjoyed it. And
Thank you.
Right to the end, I think the biggest question I had reading this book, why? Why did you go on this 400-mile journey? What sparked this? And I learned a lot by reading the last few passages in this book. So you kind of opened up there.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the trip wasn't, we never talked about what was going on in our personal lives. Yeah. Neither of the two guys getting divorced mentioned it, and no one else brought it up. So I didn't talk about it throughout the book because it really wasn't what the trip was about. And the trip really wasn't about post-combat either. It was just something that we all wanted to do and wanted to experience. And so that was why, I didn't have any sort of like higher level personal discussions during the book because it really wasn't part of the trip itself.
How masculine, don't talk about your personal life when you're on your journey, right?
Well, that's, what the journey was a respite from our personal lives. You know what I mean? Like it was a vacation from that. So
right.
There is a time and a place to talk about your personal life, but vacation isn't one of them.
Right. You actually say in the book, there's a passage where you mention getting through the day felt like scripture. And that was surprising reading that coming from an atheist.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think the Bible is a fine piece of literature. And I like the idea of scripture and God as a big, huge metaphor is completely fine as a metaphor. I just don't take it literally.
Also, the book is a history lesson in many ways, and I never realized that the Great Law of Peace by the Iroquois was the basis, or at least some scholars believe it was the basis for a U.S. Constitution.
Yeah, that's right. Thomas Paine, the Venerable Thomas Paine, looked at the Iroquois traditions, and I think it was actually that those traditions were in conversation among American intellectuals at the time. And so I don't think he pioneered that, but it definitely was sort of incorporated into the thinking, the sort of egalitarian thinking that went into the Constitution. I mean, that's my understanding anyway. There's a great book about that that I drew that from.
You mentioned too in the book, this is very important. You talk a lot about human rights, the human rights laws of the 20th century. There's a quote here, I want to read it back to you. Enshrining human rights as the apex of international law is one of the greatest achievements of Western society. It's a big part of freedom.
Yeah, I mean, until that law was passed, and not entirely after it was passed, but until that law was passed, your freedom, your community's freedom, depended on being able to defend itself through force of arms against a more powerful enemy that would kill you or enslave you. And if you couldn't defend yourself, you wouldn't remain free. And so what human rights law did was make it the matter of all nations that people remain free and their basic rights are respected by everybody. And of course, it's an imperfect world and that doesn't happen, but that's the idea anyway.
Yeah, we learned so much about the history of rail in this country. The disasters, I mean, you talk about this swarm of grasshoppers that derailed a train in Pennsylvania. And just the carnage, just the Duquesne Limited Pennsylvania derailing, that was a brutal reading, just a brutal way to die.
Yeah, it was horrific. I mean, these are the first sort of, large-scale civilian industrial disasters. Right. And I mean, people were dying one at a time in the factories, you know, all the time. I mean, that was just part of factory life, and in some ways probably still is. Yeah, that kind of large scale disaster was a, you know, precursor to, you know, airplane crashes.
Right. Yeah. And it's just very interesting hearing about the reading about the history of railroads, beheading because of a clearance that was low, some brave men.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think the expectations were lower. It was not a safe society, right? I mean, you know, children died, women died in childbirth, children died, you know, a couple might have seven children and five of them die, you know, so death was really a part of, you know, a part of the society as it was in Europe. And, you know, but even in a society like that, that was so accustomed to tragedy, the rail crashes were uniquely horrifying and pretty traumatic to people.
Also horrifying, life on the frontier. I mean, lots of gruesome deaths from early settlers, the Dutch, German, Swiss, Scotch, Irish, on the American frontier. You don't want to get captured by Indians. You do not want to face the consequences of being catched. It's freedom or death, right?
Yeah, I mean, my point is that, you know, people are willing to risk almost anything to remain autonomous. I mean, to protect their community, protect their children, and protect their autonomy, their freedom. And that's, you know, that's a, I mean, you know, I write about Genghis Khan and about the nomadic people 10,000 years ago when humanity sort of reached this big fork in the road, right? Some people became agriculturalists and were able to accumulate wealth, but were very tied to the land and very sedentary and not very free. And other people remained nomadic and were materially poor, but geographically and temporally were very free. And so there's this basic division in the human experience. And interestingly, the poor half of that equation, the nomads, right, were the ones who looked down with a kind of arrogance at the sort of affluent valley dwellers, yeah. You know, who were tilling their fields all day long. And you know, they pitied them. You know, they were very arrogant about the fact that they were nomads and they were superior to these farmers. And of course, the farmers took over the world. You know, we're the descendants of those kinds of large scale farming societies. You know, the farmers won, right? The nomads did not win. And yet they were looked down on farmers. And even today, we romanticize highly mobile groups, the Comanche motorcycle gangs, you know, whatever. I mean, if it's mobile, if it's light and mobile and can run circles around the authorities, we kind of fall in love with it.
I really enjoyed your chat with Rogue, and you touch on so much on the book and more about leadership and possibly your next book. I was researching aneurysm because seeing that interview made me think about, I don't know much about it, but is pancreatic aneurysm, is that rare?
Oh, it's unbelievably rare, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, it's an aneurysm in the pancreatic artery. It's not the pancreas itself, it's the artery that goes to the pancreas.
Right, that's right. It's usually the brain, right?
Oh, no, people have aneurysms all over the place. Aorta. I mean, yeah. The entire vascular system, it can, you know, whatever is, you know, susceptible to it. But in the pancreatic artery specifically, that's quite rare.
I really enjoyed you breaking down how, you know, we need to feel like we're part of the USA. You need to do three things. It gets ingrained with you, I think, as an immigrant myself. Joining the U.S. Air Force, it's ingrained in you that you are an American now, but civilians, they have, do you feel this obligation to take these three steps to feel like you're part of the USA?
Well, the thing about a free society is there is not an obligation in that sense. What I said on Joe Rogan is if you want to feel part of America, if that's something you actively want to do and just don't know how to do it, there are sort of symbolic ways that actually can get you quite far in feeling like you're part of something greater. And those are, you know, give blood. And the point that I made was that, you know, I needed 10 units of blood to save my life. I mean, basically I lost all my blood into my abdomen and 10 people who I'll never know.
So you feel obligated to donate blood.
I do feel obligated. Yeah. I mean, I feel morally obligated, not legally, obviously, but morally obligated. So, you know, give blood. And vote. You need to vote. I mean, your country needs you to vote, and you need your country. You know, like it goes both ways. And you know, and finally serve on jury duty. Don't try to avoid jury duty. It's a very, very, it's almost a sacred task to mete out justice in a fair and equitable way to your peers.
Yeah. It's interesting, too. You, back to the American frontier, you talk about the balance of freedom and safety. You tend to have more than one or the other at any given point. It was a tenuous time of American history.
I mean, it's, but it's always been true. I mean, there, you know, we get our safety from the community that we're in, from the country or the tribe or the group that we're part of. Humans die. Humans that are alone in the wilderness die immediately. Like, we don't survive. And so we get our safety and our emotional safety as well from the group that we're with. So that means that you're not, you know, that you have to abide by the norms of the group. You're not free from the group. You mm-hmm. never will be. And if you are free from the norms of the group, you're by yourself and you're in a huge amount of danger, which is another form of not being free.
Right. I also love the concept you mentioned of having a broad general focus. And, you know, being able to just rely on your instinct, picking up on small cues.
Yeah, that was specifically, I didn't mean that as a metaphor. That was specifically in a fight, in the boxing ring. Like, you could, the mind can see when someone's about to throw a punch, which allows you to slip the punch. And but you can only do that if you're not over-focused, right? You have to keep the sort of broad focus, and then you'll pick up these sort of almost unconscious cues that someone's preparing to throw a punch.
So it's highly illegal what you did. I mean, there probably isn't going to be very many people that are going to take this journey going forward.
Well, I don't know if it's highly illegal. I mean, it's trespassing. people trespass all the time. So who knows? I mean, it's a dangerous environment out there, and I'm not urging people to do what we did. But, you know, the crime is a lower level. It's a lower level transgression.
Right. Warped rail lines, kind of scary when you're walking right by a railroad.
Yeah, I mean, we're, you know, you're
swaying loads.
Yeah, I mean, you get out of the way when you hear them come, you know, and we would hide so the engineers wouldn't call us in, and you know, but whatever, it's still a dangerous environment. I mean, they're, you know, big heavy machines going by at 80 miles an hour, and things can happen.
Yeah,
things can happen.
And word got out. You were actually, there were shots fired over your head. There were helicopters. You possibly had a few people that wanted to join you too. So it was an adventure.
Oh, it was definitely an adventure. Yes. Yeah.
And that's not counting the rocks that could shoot like bullets or the metal strapping coming undone. Did you actually see that or?
No, I just, you know, I found out about that because I was, you know, I was curious what the dangers were out there. And a railroad guy said, you know, you can't count on everything being securely strapped down. Sometimes the strapping comes undone and, you know, it's incredibly dangerous, you know. So it's just, if you're out of the way of the train, you're not necessarily out of danger.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
There's a funny moment in the book, too, when some guy, I think he wants to get away from his wife. He'd like to join you. A bunch of strangers walking down the railroad track.
Yeah. Yeah. He didn't need much time. It was in the middle of the winter. It was very cold. And we're walking down the lines. And he said, hey, you guys, I can be back in 20 minutes with my gear if you let me come with you. Yeah, that was funny.
I'm really curious. You've hinted about your next book, possibly called Pulse. I'm really curious about this. What's the status on that?
I haven't started it yet. You know, it's about the...
It's in your mind.
Yeah, I mean, it's about what almost, you know, the incident where I almost died and what that felt like and what people experience when they nearly die, because it's a very it's puzzling what subjectively what the experience is like. I mean, my dead father appeared, and, you know, I'm an atheist. I don't believe in anything, and there he was. And, you know, I don't really know how to explain it. You know, and even as a hallucination, it doesn't explain it that well either. So, you know, I don't quite know what to say other than that I want to know more about it.
Interesting. That made me think of Michael Mellon's letter to his wife. And you mentioned this. You were very moved. And as you were reading the audiobook, the engineer had to stop it, I believe. And very powerful stuff.
Yeah, let me just explain for your listeners. Michael Mellon was an Irish revolutionary who was a big part of the Easter Rising in 1916, and which was brutally suppressed by the British. And then they executed the top dozen or so commanders, Michael Mellon being one of them. And, you know, he was given a chance to write a letter to his family right before they killed him. And it's extremely, extremely moving letter.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time there, Sebastian. You're doing press, a lot of press. So
yeah,
you seem to enjoy it, talking about your book, and that's wonderful.
Hey, thank you very much. Thanks for talking to me.
And thank you for listening to the Portland Podcast. I'm your host, Greg Day. You can contact me directly at greg@pdxpodcast.com. We'll be back with a brand new show very shortly. See you then.